Tomorrow, St. Stephen's Day, I die the death I sought, and may God forgive the mistakes and receive the intent. Ireland's freedom. Roger. I've finished. Will you please see that this is delivered? It is the last I shall write. Thank you. Yes, you may take the pen away. Dear God, does he think I would use the pen on myself after all this? That would not cheat the hangman, it would cheat myself. To be worthwhile, it must go through to the end. Sir Roger David Casement, you have been found guilty of treason, the gravest crime known to the law. Your crime was that of assisting the king's enemies, that is, the Empire of Germany, during the terrible war in which we are engaged. The duty now devolves upon me of passing sentence upon you, and that is that you be taken hence to a lawful prison, and thence to a place of execution, and that you be there, hanged by the neck, until you are dead. And tomorrow his orders will be carried out. I will be executed. And so will the order of the court. If I go right back, what is the first thing I remember? Childhood? Being a child in Sandy Cove. Being proud of father's splendid uniform and his name being the same as mine. Sandy Cove was wonderful. Sea and sand, and two big brothers to play with. And sister Nina. I'd like to see her again. It's all too patchy. I can remember so little. Except being happy sometimes. What next? Palimina and school. And Uncle's house, where all the real learning was done. About Ireland. The Academy did one good thing for me. It showed me that Irishmen must know about Ireland. For they didn't teach us anything about our own country. Local history, they called it, with scorn, while we were crammed with the dates of the reigns of English kings. Wonder if I'm local history there now. I wonder if I'm anything to them. I suppose I'm the whole country's talk, as they say. Especially to those crowds I saw when Carson was there at the review of the Ulster Volunteers. But if they could only know how proud I was to be among them. Here were Ulstermen saying to those English liberal ministers, "To hell with your politics, we mean to fight for what we believe." I couldn't believe what they believe, but I was proud of their stand. I felt I could not do anything else but go out and join the grim, hard, determined Ulster face when I saw it being shot at by Tommy Atkins. The Ulster men were the only healthy thing in the land. To hell with your politics. We mean to fight. And Asquith squirmed, as well he might with Carson and 30,000 smuggled rifles pointing at him. If only Ireland arose and said, "I too mean to fight." Then we might see daylight. But they did fight. I was too late. And they fought bravely, but at the wrong time. The daylight is still far away. What came next? Yes, Liverpool. And a long grey year in that shipping office. a pen pusher, dreaming of great adventures, filling ledgers full of the dry arithmetic of wonderful voyages, Rio, New York, Casablanca, Sydney. Oh, what a fretful year it was. Unfriendly, big English city with me in it, torn between yearning for romantic foreign places and the call of those Antrim glens. Homesick at night and yearning by day. I wonder what my life might have been if I had taken Uncle's advice and stuck at the job. Would I have a nice big office now and have made my way in the world? I might indeed. But the yearning would still be there. And now it isn't. Which is one good thing anyway. It's hard to remember years. When did I get the assistant purser's job on the ship? 1884? No, it was earlier. 1883, that's it. West Africa was the first voyage. And I remember being keyed up as we left Liverpool, me in my new uniform. First of many, as it turned out. And the goodbyes and the excitement of being on a ship. Oh, but it wasn't at all what I had imagined. I was still pen-pushing, still a sort of glorified clerk in uniform. Even those wonderful places didn't live up to what I had thought. Still, I stuck it for 4 years, because Uncle had to be faced if I went back. And besides, there were the good times. Life at sea never really suited me, but it had its moments. I'm galloping through my life. I thought there wouldn't be enough time. No, I'm all right, thank you. No, I don't want more blankets. There are sufficient. Well, it's very good of you to offer, but I'd like just to be left quiet here. They are decent men. Oh, what a terrible job watching me hour after hour. I suppose they'd be happier if I talked with them or played draughts or cards or something. But I must be quiet and not waste the time left. Remembering. Oh, where was I? Africa. What a jumbled memory of it, the first impression, as they call it. Dirty docksides. Shanty towns on the edge of the wildest of worlds. Thick sea-green forests, dark as twilight, loud with nightmarish birds. I remember vowing to return as the ship sailed, and so I did, with General Sanford's expedition. He was only playing at Explorer for the folks back home, trying to be another Stanley or Livingstone. But for me, it was the first taste. I suppose if I had to thank the British government for anything, I would thank it for giving me the chance to live in Africa and try to do good work there. Of course, the work they wanted was spying. See what the Germans are doing in the Cameroon. See what the French are up to in Dahomey. Oh, and watch the Nigerian ports for gun running. Now, there's an irony. Gun running is a thing I've had to watch all my life. Nigeria, Ulster, and Dublin. My enemies are making great play of my treachery. Casement, the servant of the crown. But I was never their servant. I wanted to do good work like the great good men of Africa. Uncle was proud of me anyway. I was making my way in the world, and the world around old Calabar anyway. Vice consul in no time, then away across the continent to be consul at Lorenzo Marques, and to do more spying on the Portuguese and on the Boers and on the ships and what was in them. It didn't really feel like spying, those long routine reports of tonnages and cargoes. Oh, what a jumble that African period was. No sooner settled on the east coast than transferred to the west again. His Majesty's Consul to the Portuguese possessions of West Africa. Chief Snooper for Angola would have been more accurate. How I itch to do something worthwhile. Report after report, request after request, that I be allowed to inspect the Congo and make a case against those barbarous Belgians and the rubber gangs. But then the war with the Boers started, and back they sent me to Lorenzo Marx, and after that to Cape Town. So much time wasted then as now. But they gave me what I wanted in the end. A post in the Congo. The great, wide, hideous Congo, hiding its fearful secrets. At last I could pry them out and do spying which would be of some real value. It took years out of my life, tramping through the endless, gloomy greenery, dosing on quinine, being sick and angry at being sick, interviewing painfully through interpreters those poor, terrified blacks who must have thought I was another white man come to torture them. Writing words, spilling the whole sordid, sickening story of the infamy of the Belgians on page after page. Trying to keep control as I met those dirty villains who smiled and said that the blacks were quite happy to work the rubber, and trying to make their evil faces look as if butter wouldn't melt in their mouths. Ah, the anger still boils inside me. Jumble, jumble, the whole period is like a tangled nightmare. The places whose names were once as natural as my own Irish towns now seem exotic and strange. Boma, Chambiri, Nzungi, Luasi, Kimfuma, and Bongandanga. It was there I saw the boy whose hands had been cut off. White eyes rolling in an ebony face, and those shortened arms, hacked off on the whim of a rubber gang monster. Monsieur Lejeune, the representative of King Leopold was too cultivated a man for that. After all, he wanted to have the natives dance in my honour. After the guards had removed their chains, of course. But paper and pen were a great release for the rage I felt. It felt good to get it all down on paper. How many words did I write then? Thousands? Millions? That would have made a big book, I'm sure. I'm quite sure that if I had not been an Irishman and an ardent believer in the nationality and rights of Ireland, I should have passed through those Congo scenes of suffering humanity with a cold, reserved heart. I should never have committed myself as I did to assume an attitude of insistence so uncompromising that the doubts of the Foreign Office chiefs were swept away. I wonder if Lansdowne and the rest knew what drove me on out there. Did they know that it was the image of my poor old country that stood first before my eyes? The whole thing had been done once to her. She, too, had been flung to the hounds. The writing was useful. The Belgians sent their commission out, and they confirmed all I had said. It was a triumph. Leopold discomfited, and myself justified. Sweet, after all that sweat and horror. It felt odd being in the public eye after years of lonely work in the jungle. All the friends I made, Morel and Cadbury. The work going well, despite those pifflers in the Foreign Office. I remember I spent Christmas at Ballycastle that year. We, tired and sick after the Congo, hoping for welcoming arms, but nobody at the station to meet me. What a disappointment. It was almost a relief to get back to London afterwards and find that the report had been well received. The country, and indeed the world, recoiled from the shock. Such uncomfortable information in the midst of decorous plenty was not easy to live with. Belgium reacted as expected, but something was done. I I thank God that I was at least useful in saving some poor black souls from death or degradation. Working with Morel in the Congo Reform Association was useful, I suppose, but I remember craving to get back to real work. By that came, too, with the offer from the Foreign Office to go to South America. Rio, and talking under that hot sun about Ireland didn't seem so strange as my friends thought. I was full of Irish feelings at that time. Not quite fitting for His Majesty's Consul General at Rio de Janeiro. Why was I always dogged by villains? I escaped the Congo to stop those robber gangs, only to end up in South America with more robber gangs. Putumayo. Oh, what memories that name brings back. Jungle, very much like that of Africa, and hiding the same, if not worse, horrors. How peculiar to have the same thing happen twice in a lifetime. First came the unpleasant rumours filtering out from the interior, the whisperings, the dreadful feeling that the rumours must be true, and no one doing anything about it, everyone embarrassed. Only me left to don the knight's armour and go and do battle with the terrible dragon. If they'd only known that I felt more like Don Quixote than Galahad. At least that time I was not alone. There were a company of worried, fearful men with me. Nice, innocent English gentlemen filled with horror at what those barbarians, those Peruvians and Bolivians who worked the slave for the rubber their company sold, had given them responsibility for. Green darkness tracks through it. Frightened little brown people listening to the painfully translated iniquities, writing them down by hand, page after page. I can even remember some of it now. In 1905, the station of Matanzas, or Andokes, was the center of a series of raids organized by the Colombian head of it, one Ramon Sanchez, at the time an agent of Arana Brothers, founders of the Peruvian Amazon Rubber Company. To this man, the first contingent of Barbados men, British subjects, was handed over. The testimony of these men, much of which will be found attached to this report and the statements made to me, was of the most atrocious description. The Indians often displayed a fortitude in the face of impending torture and death that speaks for itself of the excellence of some of their qualities. Thus it will be seen in the depositions accompanying this report how, on more than one occasion, men had refused to betray the hiding place of fugitives under terrible threats of torture if they did not point out the retreat of runaways. Armando Normand is charged with having cut the arms and legs off a chief he captured and questioned, who preferred to suffer such a death to betraying the refuge of those who had fled. What a book of horror I wrote in that Brazilian hell. Horrors written down by a civil servant for civil servants. Oh, that I could have shown the world the faces, the evil faces, the brave faces, the frightened faces. Statement of James Chase, native of Barbados, British subject. Soon after they began their march in the morning, they met in the path a child, a little girl, who was said to be the daughter of the renegade chief, Cataneri. She was frightened at the sight of the armed men, the Indians in chains and tied up, and began to cry as they approached. Vasquez at once ordered her head to be cut off. There was no reason the chase knew for the crime, save that the child was crying. Her head was cut off by a muchacho, quite a young boy. Oh, where my remembering has led me back to that. Oh, I must change to something else. Time is running on so fast. After Putumayo, there are more jumbled visions, but I remember feeling happy, illogically so, because I was able to be angry about Ireland and think about Ireland and talk with my friends in Ireland. Illogical, too, now that I think of it, that part of my happiness at returning home was getting the knighthood and being praised from the pulpits of English churches. Vanity? maybe. But I remember thinking, honor me now and praise me, but beware of me too. The rebel is only starting to live. America was exhilarating, doing good work at last. Speeches to Irish Americans, money building up to help the cause, and the British helping our cause every day. Carson inciting the North to rebellion, running guns in under the government's nose. I daren't, I suppose, have told my friends in America that I admired the Ulster men. They wouldn't have understood. But they hadn't stood and watched the Ulster volunteers march by. They were against all I believed, but they were Irishmen, defying England. Marching grimly past their brooding-faced king, while the English cabinet squirmed. It heartened me. I knew that Ireland would not be slow to follow the example, only for an opposite purpose. It was when I was in America that the move came and they landed guns for our cause at Howth. But not enough. Just enough to make the British soldiers swarm in and shoot our people down. The news of it came to me, only to be followed the next day by the announcement of the war. Anger piled on anger. And I was glad I had burned my boats, that I had committed myself really to fight for what I believed. I was wrung dry by rage and a perverse happiness. I was glad that Devoy and the other Americans had decided to ask Germany for help, and proud that I should be the one chosen to go to Berlin. Don Quixote putting on his armor again? Maybe. But Carson had thought of the same action, of asking Germany, that great Protestant nation, he called her, for help against Britain. Only he said he was thinking of it before the war. I did it while the war was on. Therefore, I was the traitor in their eyes and not he. Germany depressed me so much. Those stiffly polite people who I felt were sneering at me. I'm sure some of them even thought I was an English spy. Endless talks, endless suspicions, waiting. All I wanted was their pledge to guarantee the freedom of Ireland if they won the war. But they could not see why I, who must have appeared to them to be a strange sort of Englishman, should have gone to such trouble for something which to them seemed so trivial. They wouldn't quite believe me when I offered to enlist in the volunteer movement the Irish prisoners they had. And perhaps I was a Quixote to have trusted them. Our emerald flag was a sad joke to them. I think I wrote at that time in my diary, I go on because I am fool enough, or brave enough, or coward enough. I feel like a man already damned. I feel that all is indeed lost, and the sooner my life is taken from me, the better. Don Quixote could be a prophet, too. Is the priest here? Good. I am ready for him. I am ready. Good night, Father McCarroll. I feel as if a great weight has lifted from me. I have no fear left now. Good night. We will meet again in the morning. I feel cleansed and still inside. I did not think it possible. I'm glad I took time over joining the church again. I didn't want to jump or rush or do anything hastily, just because time is short. It has been my deliberate act, unwavering and confirmed by all my intelligence. I shall die in the Catholic faith, for I accept it fully now. It tells me what my heart sought long. I saw it in the faces of the Irish. Now I know what it was I loved in them. The chivalry of Christ speaking through human eyes. It is from that source all lovable things come. For Christ was the first knight. Why is the warder looking so strangely at me? He must see me smiling. I can smile now. You need not worry about me brooding and making your job difficult. Thank you, but I would rather sit with my memories than talk. Time is short. Oh, dear. I have embarrassed the poor man. See how he looks away in shame. I feel bad about that. Time is short. There was no reason to remind him of that. Should I say I'm sorry? No. That would make him feel worse. I'll just stay with my memories. Memories. The priest's visit has put them out of my head. Germany. The Germans turned out to be as bad as the British. They cared nothing for Ireland and treated me abominably. And I let them see I thought little of their attitude. I suppose in the end they were glad to be rid of me. And I was glad to be rid of them. And to have fooled them, too. They imagined my anxiety to get back to Ireland was to incite a rebellion which would help them against the British. But I went instead to stop the rising, for I thought it ill-timed and ill-prepared. I got what I wanted anyway. A ship full of guns and a secret landing from a submarine. The submarine. That was a voyage more dreadful than any I'd made in the Congo or Putumayo. A tiny cabin filled with sweating men, including Monteith and Bailey, my fellow conspirators. All I could do was lie sick and wretched in my bunk, too ill to sleep, too ill to eat the awful raw ham and coffee they offered. 12 days without sleep or food, no wonder I made an easy captive when we landed. But after those dreary days, what joy to be in Ireland. When I landed in Ireland that morning, swamped and swimming ashore on an unknown strand, I was happy for the first time for over a year. Although I knew that this fate awaited me, I was for one brief spell happy and smiling once more. The sand hills were full of skylarks rising in the dawn, the first I'd heard for years. The first sound I heard through the surf was their song as I waded in through the breakers, and they kept rising all the time up to the old rath at Curraghan, where I stayed and sent the others on. And all around were primroses and wild violets and the singing of the skylarks in the air. And I was back in Ireland again. As the day grew brighter, I was quite happy, for I felt all the time it was God's will that I was there. Monteith and Bailey went to Tralee to look for a motor car. I was glad when they left me in the peace of the old fort. They were gone a long time, and I relaxed and restored myself, thinking all the time I am back in Ireland. When the two policemen burst through the bushes, I felt my heart leap, but I decided to brazen it out. "If you move hand or foot, I'll shoot," one of them said. But I stood up, smiled at him, and said, "Oh, that's a nice way to treat a harmless English visitor. I've got no arms, I assure you, and will not do you any harm." I could see he was puzzled for a minute, but he kept the rifle pointing at me while his friend covered me from the side. "What's your name and what are you doing here?" they asked. "Why, my name is Richard Morton, and I'm an English writer here for a bit of peace and quiet." I wonder if old Dick will ever forgive me for using his name. But he was far away in England and couldn't do him any harm at the time. I might have got away with it. If they hadn't noticed that there was sand on my shoes, that my trouser bottoms were soaked with seawater. Still, they were not altogether convinced about me, and when we were given a lift in that boy's pony trap to the barracks at Ardfert, I quietly destroyed the secret code Monteith had left with me. At least, I thought I had destroyed it. But the boy went back and found it.